Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to a summer dinner program with the Mid-Maine Global Forum at Colby College in Waterville for a talk by Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. The title of today's talk is The Hell of Good Intentions, American Foreign Policy and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Dr. Walt previously taught at Princeton and the University of Chicago. He is contributing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, co-chair of the editorial board of International Security, and co-editor of the Cornell Studies in Security Affairs book series. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Jerry Tipper, current board member and founding member of the Mid-Maine Global Forum.
It's a really great pleasure for me tonight to have the opportunity to introduce Stephen Walt, who is the Robert Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the Kennedy School of Government. Earlier this year, I was listening to an interview on public broadcasting, and Dr. Walt was talking about one of his new books and about American policy and the decline, American foreign policy and the decline of U.S. primacy. I listened to that and I said, boy, this would be a fantastic speaker for the Global Forum and for our annual event. I contacted him and he agreed to come, and so here we are tonight for him to address that most timely topic. Today I did a little Google search on Professor Walt, and one thing it said was that he belongs to, quote, the realistic school of international relations. I will let him explain to you what that means, but it's certainly, I think it's a great time for us to get a dose of reality that will be a welcome message. Dr. Walt has authored numerous books. I won't list them all here, but one of his most recent was The Israeli Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy that became a New York Times bestseller. So, would you please give a very warm Maine welcome to Professor Stephen Walt, who will give us a timely topic.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in Waterville to talk about U.S. foreign policy, and I want to thank Jerry and the board for the invitation and thank all of you for coming. As he indicated, this talk is based on a book I published last year, which the title of that book is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. If you haven't bought the book yet, I want to compliment you on your good judgment. The reason I say that is if you just wait another month or two, the paperback edition will be coming out and you can get it more cheaply. Do not tell my publisher I gave you that advice. All right, I want to talk about two big questions tonight. And I think they're both sort of central to America's position in the world today. And the first one might be put as, how did we get here? There was tremendous optimism when the Cold War came to an end, but that doesn't seem to be the world we inhabit today. So another way to phrase that question would be to ask, what went wrong? I'm going to argue that the United States actually deserves a lot of the blame, not all of the blame by any means, but a lot of it, and we need to learn from our mistakes over the past quarter century or so. And then the second question is, well, how can we do better? And here I'll lay out the case for a different approach to American foreign policy, a different grand strategy, if you will. Now, along the way, I will also explain why Donald Trump is not the person who is likely to give us that foreign policy, despite what he said back in 2016. And I'll also say a few words about why the current level of political polarization in the country is actually so harmful to our foreign policy. It has all sorts of other negative consequences, but it also, I think, damages our ability to deal with the rest of the world in an effective way. So let me start with the bad news. Do you remember the unipolar moment back in the 1990s? The United States was clearly dominant. The wind was at our back. our only problems in the world were a few pesky dictators in some not very important countries who hadn't gotten the memo yet. They hadn't read their Tom Friedman. They didn't know that they were headed for the dustbin of history. You think back to the early 1990s, it's not surprising we were all so optimistic. We were actually on pretty good terms with all the major powers, including Russia and China. Iraq had been disarmed. Iran had no nuclear enrichment capacity. We thought we had capped North Korea's nuclear program as well. Globalization was spreading rapidly under American auspices with the formation of the World Trade Organization, the opening up of financial markets around the world. NATO and the European Union were both expanding. Democracy was spreading. The Oslo Accords gave everyone hope that we would finally have a lasting peace in the Middle East. The American military seemed unstoppable, and our economy was doing pretty well. Now think about the world of 2019. China's power and ambitions have grown steadily. Russia has seized Crimea, interfered in several other states. Relations with Moscow are now worse than at any time since the Cold War. Moscow and Beijing are increasingly aligned. Democracy is now in retreat around the world. According to Freedom House, 2018 was the 13th consecutive year in which global freedom declined. In 2017, The Economist magazine, their annual democracy index, downgraded the United States from a full to the category of flawed democracy. And in case you don't know, The Economist magazine is not an anti-American publication. Since 1993, North Korea, India, and Pakistan have all tested nuclear weapons, and Iran has acquired the capacity to build a nuclear weapon if it wants to. Repeated attempts to broker an Israeli-Palestinian peace were all humiliating failures. The two-state solution that was the goal of three different U.S. presidents is now farther away than ever. Of course, the United States was attacked on September 11, 2001. We responded by invading Afghanistan and then Iraq. Both of these wars turned out to be costly disasters that weakened our overall position. And the American military no longer looks quite so unstoppable. Indeed, much of the Middle East has been in flames, and American interference helped create failed states in Libya and Yemen and Syria. So back in 2016, when Donald Trump announced he was running for president and said American foreign policy was a complete and total disaster, and further added that the foreign policy establishment was out of touch and unaccountable, a lot of Americans nodded their heads in agreement. That was the world they thought they saw. So the question is, what went wrong? Well, I want to argue that the taproot of those failures was our commitment to a grand strategy that I'm going to call liberal hegemony. Fancy social science words. I mean liberal not in the sense of being left-wing, but a strategy that seeks to promote the classic liberal values, democracy, markets, rule of law, human rights. It's one of hegemony because it sees the United States as the indispensable nation that is uniquely qualified to lead this process and essentially turn the entire world into something more and more like the United States. When you think about it, this was a highly revisionist foreign policy. Instead of defending American territory, helping uphold the balance of power in some critical strategic regions, liberal hegemony actually sought to change local politics all over the world, if necessary, by force, and remake the world in America's image. Now, again, this sounds like a very appealing idea to us, but this approach to the world was fundamentally flawed from the start. For starters, it inflated American defense requirements. We kept extending security guarantees to more and more countries so that by 2016, the United States was formally committed to defending more states than at any time in its history. Most of these states, however, weren't doing very much to defend themselves. They were either free riding on American protection or, in some cases, doing things that were worse, essentially taking advantage of American protection to misbehave in other ways. Second, trying to spread liberal values around the world threatened non-democratic states like China or Russia, who began to resist us in various ways. But most importantly, this strategy assumed we knew how to create democracies in the wake of regime change. But as we've seen for the past 25 years, toppling foreign governments tended to lead to failed states, costly military occupations instead. And again, we should have known better. Regime change in another country destroys its existing political institutions, creates winners and the losers often take up arms to try and regain their positions. We didn't know how to pick the future leaders of these countries or how to design new institutions that would work in those societies, and our efforts to impose order there fueled corruption, led to abuses and civilian deaths, and triggered all sorts of local hatreds. But looking back, the belief that we could rapidly transform another country, to do a sort of elaborate social engineering in places like Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, and others, was positively delusional. Yet that's, in fact, what we were trying to do. Another problem with liberal hegemony was that globalization, the opening up of markets around the world, didn't quite deliver as promised. It turned out to be very good for some parts of the world and very good for some people in the United States, but not particularly good for lower and middle classes here in the United States. It also made the international financial system much more vulnerable, much more fragile, as we all learned in 2008-2009. In short, liberal hegemony, the strategy followed by the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and in fact the Obama administration, was a failure. So then the question is, well, why did we do this? Why did we attempt this ambitious crusade, and why did we keep at it in the face of repeated failures? Well, one reason is that we were in such a remarkable position of primacy. We were able to try this because it seemed like it might be possible to do. But when you think about it, we were already in such good shape, this ambitious campaign wasn't really necessary. So again, you have to ask, well, why did we decide it was time to try and spread our gospel everywhere? It's partly, I think, because liberal values are hardwired into our political culture here in the United States. Liberal states tend to be crusaders. We think we have a system that really works, and we think others will welcome it if we bring it to them. But there was another reason. There was also a strong bipartisan consensus in favor of this approach within the foreign policy elite, a consensus not fully shared by the general public. By the foreign policy elite, I mean those Americans who do foreign policy for a living, who actively engage on a regular basis. Some of you may have heard the term the blob, referring to the foreign policy establishment in Washington. This was a term coined by Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, who worked in the Obama administration. But what we mean by the foreign policy elite are the following: formal institutions of government, the President, the National Security Council, the Department of State, the Department of Defense, the intelligence services, so all of them. Membership organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, where people get involved with foreign affairs. Think tanks like the Brookings Institution, the Carnegie Endowment, the American Enterprise Institute, and literally dozens of others in Washington. Those special interest groups and lobbies who are trying to advance some foreign policy cause, whether it's human rights or arms control or whatever, and there are dozens of them as well. Those parts of the media that cover foreign affairs, and of course, scholars like me who write books and articles that shape opinion, who sometimes serve in government ourselves, or who train the people who go to fill key positions. That's what I mean by the foreign policy elite, and within that elite, there's been a strong consensus in favor of global leadership and liberal hegemony. Let me just make a couple of other comments about this elite. A couple of things about it. First, there are no formal requirements for membership. There's no required degree, no exam you have to pass. It's not like joining the bar or getting certified by a medical board. All you need to do to be a member of the foreign policy elite is convince some other people in the elite that you're smart, energetic, useful, and loyal. It's really very low barriers to entry. Second, it's a community. especially at the highest levels. Leading members know each other well, have served in multiple capacities with each other for a long time. Now, because it's a community with no real entry requirements, professional success depends first and foremost on your networks and your reputation. And that means there's a very powerful incentive to stay within the prevailing consensus. Because if you stray outside that consensus, suddenly your reputation suffers and maybe that next job won't come your way. And of course, what is that consensus? You know what many of its parts are. NATO is essential. Iran, Russia, and China are bad. Israel's beyond criticism. Nuclear proliferation is terrible, but our nuclear weapons are essential. Free trade is good. Terrorism is the absolute worst. Democracy and human rights are very important, except when our allies fall short. That's pretty much the consensus. And most important of all, the United States must exercise leadership on almost every issue and in almost every part of the world. And by the way, it also means we have the right to overthrow governments we happen to dislike if we think we can get away with it. Just for those of you who want to join the foreign policy elite, questioning those ideas is not a smart career move in Washington, D.C. Now, to show how pervasive this is, just to digress for a second, in the book, I actually talk about three bipartisan task forces, Republicans and Democrats, something called the Princeton Project on National Security, which came out in 2006, the Project for a United and Strong America in 2013, and the Center for New American Security's Task Force on Extending American Power, which was produced in 2016. Each of these was written by sort of bold-faced names from the foreign policy world, real experienced VIPs from both parties. But notice the circumstances in which they were written were quite different. One was written before the Iraq War went south and before the financial crisis. The other two were written afterwards. They are virtually identical. If you read them, they have essentially the same arguments and make exactly the same recommendations, each laying out a rather ambitious, identical blueprint for American global leadership. Now, a couple more comments about the elite. There are sometimes disagreements within the elite over specific foreign policy issues, such as what to do about Syria or how to deal with Iran. But in Washington, voices supporting this idea of liberal hegemony and American leadership have far outweighed the voices calling for the United States to act with greater restraint. And why does the foreign policy elite like liberal hegemony so much? Well, partly because many of the people here genuinely believe in these principles. They think this is good for the United States and good for the world. That's why I said it's the hell of good intentions. But trying to remake the world in America's image also increases their power and status, flatters their sense of self-worth, justifies bigger budgets, and gives them all plenty to do. The snarkiest line in my book is to say that liberal hegemony is a full employment policy for the foreign policy elite. What's most interesting, however, is that the American people actually have a somewhat different view of these questions. On the one hand, they reject genuine isolationism. There's very little support for, you know, retreating to Fortress America here in the United States, and that's been true for decades. But they also seem to want a much more restrained foreign policy. In 2013, for example, 80% of Americans believed, quote, we should not think so much in international terms, but concentrate on our own national problems and building up strength here at home. That was 80% in 2013. 83% say that domestic problems should take precedence over foreign policy issues as well. And by the way, that's especially true of millennials. The younger Americans are much less inclined to want to run around the world reforming everything. Equally important, consider that the last four U.S. presidents were elected promising to do less in foreign affairs. What was Bill Clinton's mantra in 1992? It's the economy, stupid. George W. Bush said he would give us a humble foreign policy, no nation building. Barack Obama got elected because he'd opposed the Iraq War, and he promised to do nation building at home. And of course, Donald Trump was critical of all of his predecessors and the foreign policy elite. So one final question. How does the foreign policy elite convince the rest of the United States to tolerate this strategy, even when it keeps failing, even when it's failing over and over? Well, I think there are four methods. One, you exaggerate threats to convince Americans they won't be safe if they aren't meddling all over the world. Second, you exaggerate the benefits of an ambitious foreign policy by claiming that it will create stability in parts of the world or will help spread our values, which it's not doing, I think, pretty visibly. Third, by concealing the costs. We finance our wars now by borrowing the money and running deficits, or we use the all-volunteer force, air power, and drones to keep casualties low. And finally, by not holding anyone accountable. Consider that the people responsible for the Iraq War remain respected figures within the foreign policy elite, and some of them, like John Bolton, are in top jobs today. If you're a member of the foreign policy elite, you can give classified information to your mistress, lie to the FBI about it, plead guilty and pay a fine, and resume a prominent role as a well-regarded expert. You can be convicted of lying to Congress, get pardoned, go back into government, screw up again, land a nice sinecure at a prestigious think tank, and then eventually become the president's special envoy for Venezuela. By contrast, those who challenge the consensus view usually get marginalized even when they turn out to be right. And let me just give you one example. Colonel Paul Yingling. Paul Yingling was an artillery commander who served two tours in Iraq. And while in Iraq, he wrote an article called A Failure of Generalship, which he published in an Army journal. He was asked if he wanted to publish it anonymously, and he forthrightly said, no, I'll publish it under my own name. And it basically was a stinging critique of the way in which generals were commanding the war effort in Iraq in 2004, 5, and 6. It was widely hailed as an accurate appraisal of some of our strategic mistakes in Iraq. It was assigned as required reading at West Point and at the Command and General Staff College, right? So Yingling was right, but here's the obvious question. What happened to Paul Yingling? Did he rise in our Army? No. He retired at the rank of colonel and is now teaching high school in Colorado. In other words, I'm suggesting the foreign policy world is in many ways a self-protecting community. Lots of other communities, by the way, act the same way. Universities protect their faculty when they shouldn't. The Catholic Church protected priests when they shouldn't. The question you want to ask yourself, is this a healthy situation? If the people who repeatedly get things wrong pay little price for it and just get new opportunities to screw up, and the people who get things right don't get recognized for it, why should we expect to do better over time? All right, this is the point where you say, but wait, wasn't Trump going to fix this? Wasn't he going to drain the swamp, challenge the blob, make America great again? I'm afraid the answer to that is no. And the chapter about Trump in the book is called How Not to Fix Foreign Policy. Now, he has done some things differently. I think that's obvious, especially in terms of his personal style. We've never had a president who acted this way, both at home and abroad. He's openly questioned NATO, treats our democratic allies with visible contempt, dislikes the EU intensely, appears to have no real interest in democracy or human rights or things like that in other countries, is unusually fond of authoritarian leaders, thinks he has some sort of special rapport with Kim Jong-un. He did do some things that were also different, that weren't just style. He walked away from the Iran deal, the Paris Climate Accord, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So I don't want to suggest that he has had no effect at all, right? And it's not just style. But as with the transition from Bush to Obama, there's a lot of continuity still in the Trump administration. So apart from the trade war with China, which is now looking pretty serious, most of his other trade disputes with other countries have led to new trade agreements that were almost identical to the old ones. The new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico is not a significant different, is not significantly different from NAFTA, for example. Our new trade agreement with South Korea is not significantly different than the one that existed before. Despite Trump's criticisms, our commitment to NATO remains intact. And by the way, his main complaint about NATO, that Europeans aren't spending enough on defense, is a complaint that goes all the way back to Dwight D. Eisenhower. We've been complaining about that for decades. We have the same set of allies in the Middle East. Our hostility to Iran is nothing new. Yes, he left the Iran deal, but the Iran deal was one of those issues in Washington where it really was a sort of 50-50 split. Strong supporters on one side, strong critics on the other. Obama went with one side, Trump has gone with the other. Just like Barack Obama, in his first year as president, Donald Trump sent more troops to Afghanistan. We are still doing nation building there, or at least trying to. He has criticized China and Iran for human rights abuses, but not Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Egypt, or Israel. That's no different than his predecessors either. Russia is still facing sanctions over Ukraine. China is still seen as our primary long-term competitor. And we're still spending more on defense than the next seven countries put together, and still chasing terrorists in more than a dozen countries. What I'm suggesting, in short, is that the obvious changes in presidential style are greater than the changes in foreign policy substance. And in my view, we now have the worst of both worlds. We still have an overly ambitious foreign policy, but with an incompetent skipper at the helm of the ship of state. We are also deeply divided as a country, and this affects foreign policy in a number of ways. I was really pleased, by the way, to hear you both say that one of the purposes of this forum is to have sort of bipartisan or nonpartisan discussions, and that's exactly what's needed here. Why does this affect foreign policy? Well, first of all, when we're divided as a country, it's hard to address domestic issues, opioids, climate, the deficit, education, gun violence, domestic terrorism, infrastructure. And that means the country gets weaker over time if we can't address problems at home because of our divisions. Second, it leaves us more vulnerable to external meddling, like the meddling that Russia has tried to do in social media and things like that. When we're deeply divided, we're more vulnerable to that. When we're divided, other states can't trust us as well. Why reach an agreement with one administration when the next one is just going to reverse course and tear up the deal? It's, by the way, worth noting that the United States almost never signs formal treaties anymore. We do executive agreements instead. Why? Because when we sign a formal treaty, it has to be ratified by the Senate. And when we're deeply polarized, presidents can't necessarily get a treaty through the Senate. So they do executive agreements instead. Polarization, of course, also hurts the American image. It hurts our brand. The more divided, corrupt, gridlocked we are, the less others are going to look to us as an example or listen to our advice. As our image declines, so does our influence. Just think about how events like El Paso, Dayton, and many others lead people around the world to see our country. I think you couldn't hand America's enemies a better talking point than something like that. Finally, polarization also damages efforts to get Congress to play a more active role in providing oversight and approval for foreign policy. Presidents have been taking more and more power over time, ever since World War II, if not before. And Congress has shown some signs in the last few years of wanting to get some of that authority back. But if it uses that oversight for strictly partisan purposes, just to punish the president from the opposite party, it's not going to be particularly effective. It's not going to ultimately do what it's supposed to do. So trying to move our politics back towards greater amity and respectful disagreement, I think, would actually give us a road to a more effective foreign policy. All right, so let me try and wrap this up, as I do in the book, by outlining a different approach, a different way of doing business. Instead of what I've called liberal hegemony, we should adopt a strategy that some of us in my business have been calling offshore balancing. You sometimes hear it called a strategy of restraint. And the core logic of this strategy is pretty simple. it recognizes first and foremost that the United States is still an extraordinarily secure country. We still have the world's largest economy. It's very diverse. It's very innovative. We still have the world's most capable military forces. We are still protected from many dangers, not all dangers, but many dangers, by these two enormous ocean moats. We have no major power rivals anywhere near our country, no nuclear weapon states in the Western Hemisphere as well. We're in about as good a geopolitical position as any country has ever been. In terms of world politics, the main threat to the United States would be a peer competitor, a country as strong as we were, that dominated its neighborhood, dominated its region, the same way we basically dominate the Western Hemisphere, and therefore a state that could project power around the world the same way the United States does. When you think about it, why are we able to wander all over the world getting into trouble? Because we're not worried about protecting Minnesota from Canada. Right? We're in this remarkably favorable position. So we'd have to worry if some other country were in a similar position. It was so secure in its own region, it could then project power all over the world. It might even project power into the Western Hemisphere, something the United States really hasn't had to worry very much about for over a century. So one of our big, maybe our most important strategic goals should be to make sure no other country dominates its region the way we dominate the Western Hemisphere. If possible, we should get others to do that for us. We should try to pass the buck to others, let them prevent that from happening. But we may not be able to do that under all circumstances. That way, of course, we would be able to husband our own strength, husband American lives. What does that all mean for us today? Well, China is really the only potential regional hegemon out there, the only state that could dominate its region the way we dominate ours. So we should be focusing most of our attention on balancing China in Asia. We should gradually reduce our military role in Europe and let the Europeans handle their own defense, which they're capable of doing if they put their minds to it. Just some statistics here. Europe combined has about 500 million people. Its combined GDP is a little bit smaller than ours, about $17 trillion. Russia, by contrast, is only 140 million people, and the Russian economy is smaller than Italy's, smaller than Canada's, less than $2 trillion. All right? NATO's European members, not counting the United States, NATO's European members spend between 3 and 4 times what Russia spends on defense every year. They don't spend it very well. They don't spend it very efficiently or effectively. But, you know, if you go back 20 or 30 years, for example, Germany had a quite formidable military. I'm not talking about World War II. I'm talking about in the 1980s. Germany had a quite competent military. They have let their military capabilities atrophy terribly. So, and in my view, the only way we're going to see Europe actually take responsibility for its own defense is if the United States makes it clear it's not going to do that any longer. This shift should be gradual. It should be amicable. We're not doing this because we're mad or because we're angry. And by the way, if we move in that direction, we should also be pro the European Union, not hostile. Because one of the things that keeps European politics relatively tranquil has been the European Union, and tranquil European politics is in our interest. When European politics gets exciting, that usually is bad news. Finally, the United States should reduce its presence in the Middle East and have normal relations with all countries there, including Iran, instead of special relations with some of them and no relations with others. Why do I say that? I say that because that would maximize American influence and leverage. When Mike Pompeo lands in Riyadh to talk to the Saudis, I want the Saudis to know that his next stop is Tehran. And when he's in Tehran, I want the Iranians to know that his next stop is Tel Aviv. And when he's in Tel Aviv, I want them to know his next stop is maybe Ankara. Because that gives each of those countries an incentive to tell Pompeo something he might want to hear, lest he get a better deal someplace else. We should put much more emphasis on diplomacy. Think of military power, sanctions, and coercion as our last resort rather than our first impulse. And last but not least, we should promote our political values abroad, like democracy and human rights and law and markets, by setting a good example here at home so that other countries will see what we're able to do here and will want something like that for themselves. I want to emphasize I'm not recommending isolationism. The United States would still be engaged around the world economically, diplomatically, and in some places, militarily. But we would not be squandering resources needlessly, and we could devote more time, attention, and money to fixing problems here at home. In his book, The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith wrote, "There is a lot of ruin in a nation," by which he meant it takes a long time to really screw things up if you're wealthy and powerful. And that's especially true when a country has as many advantages as the United States still enjoys. I think good fortune has allowed us to survive a rather cavalier and unrealistic approach to foreign policy. I sometimes say this confirms Bismarck's quip that there seems to be a special providence that looks after fools, drunkards, and the United States of America. I think the real danger we face is not a powerful alliance of clever foreign adversaries who are going to snatch our security, prosperity, and way of life away from us. Rather, the problems we are facing at home and abroad are mostly of our own doing. As Walt Kelly put it many years ago, we have met the enemy and he is us. So we're at something of a crossroads as a country. Down one road lies more of the same, with the same disheartening results. Down another road lies a more realistic strategy that actually is what we used to do in foreign policy, served our country quite well, and I think would do so again if adopted. It is not the foreign policy that the current occupant of the Oval Office can deliver, but I think it is the foreign policy that most Americans want and deserve. And the real question is, how long is it going to take before they get it? Thank you very much for your attention, and I will look forward to questions and comments. Thanks very much.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Dr. Walt will now answer questions from the audience.
Hello. My question relates to what seems to be an increasing worldwide problem with refugee populations, which are generated by conflicts all over the world and by people fleeing criminal persecution and things like that. And what would be a reasonable foreign policy approach for the United States and for other countries to address this refugee problem?
It's nice that you've picked such an easy question to try and solve. The international system that we have is based on separate states. Those states have borders, and those borders have to be respected to some degree. That I don't think we are yet ready to live in a world where there is absolute and complete free movement of peoples. And I think what we've seen over the last 25 years or so is that even at a rather modest level, that can have really poisonous effects on recipient countries' politics. It's part of what's driving the nativism in Europe and I think here in the United States. I don't think it's controversial to say that countries should have some ability to regulate, monitor, control who is going in and out. That's, I don't think, particularly controversial. How you then deal with sort of humanitarian disasters of either an immediate sort, like a civil war, or just degrading social conditions that are leading many people to flee is complicated. We saw this with the Syrian civil war, which flooded Europe with refugees. We've seen it here in the United States with people coming up from Central America. We also see it elsewhere in Europe with people migrating from sub-Saharan Africa, in part due to population increase there and in part due to civil strife of various kinds. I think what you end up having is a package of responses. No one tool in the toolkit actually solves the problem for you. So the Europeans, in addition to increasing monitoring of their coastlines and trying to stop people from coming, have also worked with governments in North Africa, even worked with warlords of various kinds in North Africa to try and stop the problem there. Here in the United States, it seems to me it's incredibly short-sighted to think we should be doing this by doing it at the American border. We should be doing much more to try and improve circumstances in Central America so that people are less likely to want to leave. What most people, I think, in the United States don't understand is that most of the people who are fleeing these countries actually would rather be in their homeland. They would rather be where they grew up. They would like greater opportunities. They would like greater personal security. They would like those societies to be working better. That would be their first choice. Coming to the United States, something that's inherently risky, expensive, et cetera, fraud is not a choice they would make. So I think we've been short-sighted in not trying to address the problem at its cause and simply treating it as something we're going to deal, you know, at the U.S.-Mexican border. Sort of at that point, it's kind of too late to think of any particular intelligent response to it. And then finally, if we're going to do more on this front, you'd like it to be done much more competently than we have been. If you have to deal with a large refugee population, then you want to do it in a way that is admirable and wins approval from the rest of the world, rather than doing it in a way that's, to me, is an appalling violation of our basic values, the way in which some of these people have been treated. But I should add one thing. I think it's an incredibly difficult problem, and lots of other countries around the world are facing similar problems that we are.
You seem to have some great ideas. What type of influence do you have? Have you spoken to any politicians or any people in order to pursue what you have talked about?
yes, I have spoken to a number of politicians of various sorts. You'd be surprised, a fair number of them wander through Harvard at one time or another. So I get to speak with them then. I do write books. I write a weekly column for Foreign Policy magazine, which I'm told gets read, at least by some people. And I try to train as many students as possible to go off and do something useful. I've also been indirectly involved in putting together a new think tank in Washington. I don't want to overstate my role in this. Some of you may have read about it. It's called the Quincy Institute, and it's an interesting, it's designed to be a think tank pushing ideas similar to the ones I outlined here. What's interesting about it is some of its initial funding has come from George Soros, and one of the other major funders is the Charles Koch Institute. So you have George Soros and Charles Koch, who probably don't agree on very much, but they do agree that American foreign policy has gone off the rails and needs to get put back on a more sensible course. We'll see how that new think tank does.
Yes, within the context of the theory of the rise and fall of great powers, I think some people might think that we are, as a power, on our decline, on the slope downward. And I'd be interested in your view and sort of how that looks as the United States' future.
It's always tricky to answer questions like this, only because it depends on what date you want to pick. So if you pick the day 1945, then we're definitely on the decline. In 1945, the United States was fully half of gross world product, right? We were in some respects, a pinnacle there. When you think about it, the United States had 10 million people in the services, sole possession of the atomic weapons, and were 50% of the world economy in 1945. All those numbers look down. But of course, 1945 is a terrible date to pick. It's the end of World War II. Europe has been destroyed. Much of Asia has been destroyed. It's a kind of artificial date to pick. Back in the 1980s, people thought the United States was declining. Paul Kennedy, a famous historian at Yale, made a lot of money, sold a million copies of a book called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And what made that book really sell was the last chapter, where he talked about how the United States was succumbing to imperial overstretch like Great Britain had, and was about to be replaced by a new great power, Japan. Right? Kennedy turned out to be wrong. The United States had a great run in the 1990s. The Soviet Union collapsed. The Japanese bubble also collapsed. They've never fully come out of that as well. So the United States is not going to be in the same position of dominance we were in the 1990s. That was somewhat artificial as well. China's rise had not yet fully taken hold, and the Soviet Union had just imploded. But I think the United States is still in an extraordinarily good position. And therefore, if we play our cards right, make intelligent decisions, we're going to be, if not the world's most powerful country, one of the world's two most powerful countries. And we have a lot of advantages relative to China. We have a much nicer neighborhood to live in. I've already outlined why our situation is so nice. Think about being China for a second. You have 14 countries on your borders. You have border disputes with many of them. There are four countries on your borders with nuclear weapons: North Korea, Pakistan, India, and Russia. You have the world's most powerful country, has formal treaties and military forces stationed in places like Japan, South Korea, Australia, and an increasing strategic partnership with India as well. So if I were in Beijing looking out at the world would look actually kind of dangerous to me. My neighborhood looks problematic, whereas the Americans are in great shape in lots of different ways. So I think the United States is actually in relatively good shape. And as I suggested at the end, our biggest danger is self-inflicted wounds, making bad choices here at home that undermine our position, either because we're doing foolish things abroad or we're failing to take steps that we should be taking here at home.
What effect does or will climate change have on foreign policy?
It's almost like a separate lecture. So let me say I'm not an expert on climate change, but I think it's going to have a number of them. First of all, and I should add that what's got me more and more concerned is the sense that the worst case estimates are looking more and more likely in terms of how fast atmospheric temperatures are rising, what some of the implications of that are. So all around the United States, this is going to have consequences for coastlines, right? How many of you have, like, docks anywhere on the, maybe not here in Waterville, but it's going to have a big, there are America's largest naval base, Newport News, is going to be underwater. At least parts of it are going to be underwater. So it's going to have all sorts of infrastructure consequences for the United States. And nobody can give you a price tag for what it's going to cost not to mitigate these problems, just to adapt to it. If you think about replacing sewer systems, electrical systems, building seawalls, what do you do about Florida? What do you do about New Orleans, et cetera? And where's the money going to come from to pay for all of those things? I mean, I actually think this is going to have real consequences just here in the United States. And it's inevitably going to impinge on budgets, leaving less money for other things, including foreign policy. Second thing, it's going to have climate change is already affecting, crops, temperatures, livability, access to water. I was reading an article today about, I think in the New York Times, about the number of countries around the world that are essentially approaching the limits of their water resources. And countries, because one of the things climate change does is it increases the volatility. You have some years where you have too much water and you get flooding, and then you have 4 years of drought and you run out in various ways. And that's going to then contribute to the very first issue we talked about, which is refugee flows, people leaving places that are no longer viable because rainfall patterns or access to water has diminished. And that, in fact, then turns into a source of international conflict. And one final thing. I wrote in my foreign policy column this week a speculative, I emphasize the word speculative, essay on the implications of Brazil's decision under the new Brazilian president, Bolsonaro, to expand development efforts in the Amazon rainforest. Right. The Economist magazine, actually, the cover story was Death Watch on the Amazon. Right. And this has actually non-trivial effects on for lots of other countries and possibly for the climate as a whole. So my speculation was, you know, if Brazil, exercising national sovereignty, we're just doing what we're doing inside our own country. It's our business. It's our Amazon. Thank you very much. Does this, but it's affecting others. Would other states take action to stop them? Turns out the Brazilians have been worrying about this for a long time. My column got a furious reaction out of Brazil, to judge by my Twitter feed and some of my emails, right? Because they thought I was suggesting the United States or others should be, you know, attacking or threatening Brazil to get them to stop. But we've seen things like this in the past. Countries that are upstream on a river that crosses national borders can cause a conflict if they start damming the river and denying the downstream countries the water, right? People have fought wars over that in the past. This analogy holds, right? If people are doing things that are going to make climate change worse, other states are going to try to take action of one kind or another to get them to stop. An alternative is we could pay Brazil. Right, we understand that developing the Amazon would be beneficial for Brazil from a purely economic point of view. We don't want you to do it, so we'll pay you not to burn the Amazon down. Not, that's better than going to war with Brazil. The international community agrees to compensate Brazil for preserving the rainforest, helping defray the costs. But do you want to encourage other states to say, well, I've got a valuable resource here that the world depends on? Be really awful if something happened to it. Why don't you pay me not to do something to it? I think these are actually incredibly complicated questions, and given the potential implications of really altering our climate in ways we've never seen, I think that if we don't have an effective collective global response, the potential for conflict over these sorts of issues is going to go up and up and up. But I'm not planning on visiting Brazil anytime this month. Yes, sir.
This might be a little off the wall, but the one aspect, like climate change, that you did not speak of in your regular talk is population growth, that the population growth is going up almost exponentially, and that all over the world we have the migrations, not just from climate change, but just sheer volume of peoples. China, something like 25% of their college graduates can't get jobs. And all around the world, is this something that's going to make traditional diplomacy, even as you outlined a better way, outmoded, that they're problems we've never thought of before?
I don't disagree with what you said, but it's important to understand that population issues are not, it's not global in the sense that the trends are different in different parts of the world. So, you know, parts of Europe now are depopulating, right? And Japan and South Korea are depopulating and aging very rapidly. I think Japan and South Korea are going to be the two oldest societies on the planet relatively soon, if they aren't already. It's true of much of Western Europe, et cetera. Because there is a pretty iron law of demography that as countries develop economically, as per capita income goes up, fertility goes down, people have, when they get richer, they have fewer kids, which sounds paradoxical, but in fact, a large family is a hedge against all sorts of uncertainty. And that's been true all across the world. As countries get richer, they have fewer children. So in many parts of the world, we're actually seeing population growth decline, but not everywhere. And it raises this interesting paradox, right, of, you know, places like, as I mentioned, sub-Saharan Africa. There's going to be tens of millions of people who won't have jobs they can get. Those countries are not going to develop fast enough economically under the most optimistic of scenarios to provide jobs for all the children who are now children will soon be adults. So where are they going to look? They're not going to look in the United States for the most part because the Atlantic Ocean is very large. But they will look in Europe. They'll look in other places that they can get to, which is why Europe has a bigger problem with refugees, it seems to me, than the United States does. I think that this is, it's one of the reasons why America's the family planning dimension of American foreign policy has been so, I think, inappropriate, right? If you're worried about, we basically, because of opposition to abortion, we've had big restrictions on the amount of funding we will provide for family planning efforts in other societies. And this strikes me as short-sighted. We should be helping other countries and people in other countries manage their fertility so that they can make intelligent choices. And I think we'd all be better off as a result over the long term.
Stephen, a lot of what you've talked about tonight is a discussion of the status quo that's been happening for decades. Would you describe to us some of the true black swan events that you are concerned with that no one is anticipating, but that will truly create disruption in the world, with an emphasis on the collapse of credit funding, where it's not how much debt a nation might have, but only the ability to be able to fund that debt? And if those things are cut off, what sorts of disruptions could that create in our world?
I'll just mention two. So you mentioned the idea of a financial panic. I mean, we don't actually, that's not so much a black swan. It was only 11 years ago that we went through one of these, the biggest one since the Great Depression. And, you know, that taught a lot of us, and I'm not a finance person, but it taught a lot of us that, you know, financial markets are different than other markets in that they depend very heavily, as your question implied, on confidence, right? If I owe somebody $1 billion, but that person is confident that I can pay the $1 billion over time, then that's an asset on their books. The day that they decide I probably aren't going to pay that $1 billion back, then they're in real trouble. And that situation could arise again, and there are, I know some people who are worrying that we're replaying some of the conditions that led to the financial crisis of 2008, and at that point I exceed my expertise on this subject. Second thing that people worry about in terms of black swans is some kind of global pandemic. You know, think of the SARS epidemic that didn't quite take off, an Ebola epidemic that escapes the local areas. People have talked about a strain of flu like the 1919 global influenza, which killed, I think, 100 million people worldwide. And you can read things. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a public health epidemiologist. But you can read things to say, you know, this is inevitable. It's going to happen sooner or later that the viruses will, in fact, mutate in a way that's particularly communicable, particularly lethal. And we live in a much more connected world than we used to, where suddenly someone could be sick in Madrid and fly to Sydney, Australia, and spread things in that way as well. Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He recently spoke with the Mid-Maine Global Forum on American foreign policy and the decline of U.S. primacy. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.